Taylor Price is a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto's Department of Sociology. His key areas of expertise include cultural sociology, sociological theory, and quantitative research methods. In this episode, we discuss his PhD dissertation, which looks at the life cycles of songs by drawing from interactionism and the sociology of culture.
So hi, Taylor, and welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here today, and I'm excited to know more about you and about the research you've been doing. So to get us started, I'd just like to know a little bit about yourself, about your academic background, and more specifically about your interest in music, cognition, and creativity as areas of research broadly that you've been looking at.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Abba, for having me. It's really cool to be on this podcast and to be virtually with a lot of colleagues from all over the world. So I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto. I'm kind of in the ending phases, hopefully, drafting my dissertation right now, which is modeled after three peer-reviewed journal articles. So still crafting those up right now, but that's based off of kind of a three-year ethnography that I did with songwriters in Toronto. And so, yeah, I submitted my dissertation proposal in December, or had that approved in December 2019. And then the pandemic happened. Luckily, I managed to kind of pull the project out of the tailspin that was caused by the pandemic, and got to interview a lot of songwriters and actually spend time with them when, you know, the COVID restrictions allowed. Plus, I got to see some of their songwriting sessions over Zoom. So I'm really interested in zeroing in on creative moments and creative situations, like what happens when people get together and then all of a sudden there's something there that wasn't there before. So the whole kind of project is premised on using songs and creative situations as the unit of analysis. So following the song from creation all the way to reception was the original plan, but I mostly focused now on creation and creativity, and that's the main focus of the dissertation now, and planning to kind of keep going further down the process in later papers.
Definitely, right? And I think, you know, this whole aspect of creativity also is something really interesting, because a lot of people speak about it, you know, along the lines of it's just about creating something out of nothing. But I don't think that's always the case, right? Because, you know, you do have all of these different influences. And of course, I think the more experienced you are in some sense, I think, you know, a lot of it, you know, builds up in that sense, right? So I just, at a societal sort of level, right? How is creativity sort of understood? And especially in the context of music, how do we really, you know, channel it and you know, make use of it in that sense?
Right. I really love that. I appreciate that you said that, because it just immediately made me think that, yeah, kind of thinking of creativity as creating something out of nothing is perhaps a bit of a myth. Because it's more like people are creating something out of something else. And so, I don't know, kind of working your way up, you could think about, from smaller levels to bigger levels of sociological analysis. A lot of the things that people are used to make new things are these developed capacities to make new things, right? One of the, I was recently reading and having to cite this recently, but the classic study of the David Sudnow, who learned how to do improvised jazz piano. So in kind of learning how to improvise, he demystified that idea to say that it's not so much that people are just making up random things on the spot and it comes out of nowhere. It's more so that through this process of sustained immersion in this jazz community and in one's own practice of jazz, which is alone or with others, you develop, he called them stockpiles of places to go. So it was it was more little tricks that you could do in certain situations, and you may never have played it exactly that way before, but I think that helps to fit with that idea of you're not creating something out of nothing, you're creating it out of these skills and dispositions that you've developed over time with others and by yourself. A really kind of updated version of that is Ju Young Lee's work on hip hop artists who freestyle, showing kind of the same sort of thing, is that it's very much based in this sort of like developing tricks and little things to do on the fly, which are more or less practiced and not so much like, yeah, coming out of nowhere. I'm not sure if I answered the question though. What was the, oh yeah, right. There's more than that, right? Because we were thinking about like on the societal level, and then, yeah. So like taking that up a step and thinking not just like, okay, you know, people are developing these dispositions and immersing themselves in various communities to do that and whatever, right? These different distributions, or like, I'm trying to get towards the concept of like cultural capital, right? And how people's familiarity or comfort with different communities and kind of immersing themselves in them aren't equally distributed. So that shapes creative behaviors as well, on a more social level. Or I guess, yeah, the grander unit of social analysis, you could say.
right, yeah. And yeah, right. You know, I mean, like, at least like the way that I have seen it is that whenever we try to understand creativity, we always look at what happens in the brain, right? You know, and that takes us into, you know, this whole other area of cognition. And, you know, and of course, when we speak about cognition, we think of psychology, right? And I think, you know, at a more, at the most like fundamental level, you know, cognition essentially is, you know, all of the stuff that happens mentally, you know, through which we gain knowledge and comprehension. But I think what's really interesting is that you've looked at it again, right? Like from the level of like society and like you were just, you know, like bring up the idea of culture and like capital in that sense. So yeah, so I think along those lines, I just like know a little bit about where cognition really, you know, like comes in like the creativity process and how you really use this concept in your research.
Right. Yeah. And that's a really interesting question and something I'll try to get into a little bit. I'm not one of the things, yeah, it's like a bit weird, but it's something I've been thinking about a lot. And I don't know how much I'll just like free flow thinking just because I'm working on a paper right now that I'm like about to submit. But yeah, so in terms of like cognition and the creative process, I'd say that, yeah, it links back to what I was saying earlier with kind of developing this kind of creative capacity to make new things. Sorry, I'm kind of losing the train of my thought here. Sorry, can we start that one again? I'm just not.
yes, I mean, you know, I think fundamentally, right, I think the question is that we always understand cognition in a psychological way as to what's really happening in the brain. But right. I just like to know a little bit about how you sort of, you know, taken that idea and, you know, like sociologically played around it and used it to understand creativity better.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So yeah, like we were saying, like creativity is something that like we think of that happens in the brain, and the like the story that I was talking about in terms of like developing these like capacities by immersing yourself and kind of developing like these kind of tricks or stockpiles of places to go or whatever, right? So sociologists have also used cognition in like that way of like creativity is something that happens in the brain. And yeah, that's where like these new kind of formulations or new, what would they call them? Like new configurations of these like cultural elements happen. And which like shapes the configuration of the material elements as well. I think we could also, one of the things that I like to do or that I want to do in my dissertation, which yeah, I won't get too far into the details, but just kind of explaining the general scope of that, is that we can kind of expand the site of cognition from just like within somebody's skull to kind of group processes or how they interact with technologies as well. This is like a classic concept from Hutchins's distributed cognition. And there's a really good paper by Matthew Norton in the American Journal of Cultural Sociology that gets into this, that kind of, yeah, that articulates that in a really succinct and nice way, which is basically like people think together and they think with tools. So you can't necessarily say that all of the thinking happens within just one brain or across multiple brains, right, or whatever. It's like you have to kind of take in that whole context to understand the cognitive process. So yeah, I want to do that to look at songwriting sessions and how people make songs. So that's kind of one of the overarching questions of the whole dissertation project.
For sure, yeah. And, you know, I think going into the, you know, whole ethnography process a little bit more, right? Like, what really does a songwriting session look like, you know, especially like the time that you were there?
Yeah, so it's, you know, there's so much variation in terms of like social life. But, you know, generally, there's like a session before where people kind of hang out, catch up, talk about things, you know, whatever, that can last for anywhere from like 10 minutes to 3 hours or whatever. Then, you know, when people finally get into like a creative mood or get enough into a creative mood to start messing around, there's usually like a period of kind of just free flowing ideas, people trying to like find something to work with. And then it's kind of a process of building off of that. Like, it's often not explicitly debated. Like, people aren't saying like, yeah, I know, making like a pros and cons list versus this melody or one note versus the other, right? It's like more about feel and stuff like that. And so, yeah, it's very much like a process of building off of ideas, happenstance. I was thinking about, or I was watching the Beatles documentary on Get Back, and I felt like that really helped to show like a lot of themes in most songwriting sessions. In terms of, like I was saying, like it's about building off of ideas and happenstance. On one of the sessions where they show like the initial creation of Get Back, the song, like they kind of show that that song wouldn't have been created if John Lennon wasn't late that day for whatever reason. I'm not exactly sure, but so it's just like Paul McCartney messing around, comes up with this weird sounding yelp, and then turning that into a set of words, which is Get Back, which meant basically nothing at that session. And then there was something about in that documentary about how there was some sort of political moment in terms of like immigrants and something like that. I can't remember all the details. Then they're like, oh, let's use this as like inspiration for the song and like Get Back. And it just kind of worked. And a lot of songwriting sessions are like that. I feel like that's like a really exceptional example. And I think it's a good example because it's a song that everybody knows, but it really shows like all of the work and chaos that goes into a song.
For sure. Yeah. And in fact, you know, I think this whole creative process is just so interesting, right? Because I think it reminds me a little bit of, you know, my own work in advertising, you know, where like, I don't know if you've like heard of this, right? But a lot of like ad agencies that we are different, we are unique, like we want to, you know, make a breakthrough. And I mean, everyone's just trying to make a breakthrough. Like, you know, there really are no, you know, unique ideas in that sense, right? And you know, I think that also makes me think, right? You know, like when you have certain deadlines that you have to meet, right? Then, you know, can you really have the structure on what the creative process should look like? Or is it just, you know, that like a lot of, you know, like trial, you know, and error like just happens and things just, you know, like go like along with the flow in that sense? You know, like what really does that sweet spot or like that balance between the two look like, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have a good answer for it. I feel like that's like a really good, well, I have some inklings of like answers, but I feel like that's a framing of the question of creativity that's really prominent in research areas like management studies, because they're looking really at like, how do you optimize creative groups and like, how do you support creative projects? So yeah, I don't know. I would like for, in terms of like developing a sweet spot between deadlines and creativity, that is definitely an interesting research question, which I can't really speak too much. Cause yeah, in the music making communities that I studied, it's very much like a free flowing thing. Like deadlines don't mean a lot. And I think that that really helps with creativity. So I think you're really right to say that that's pointing out conflicting forces in the creative process. And so, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't want to say too much. I don't want to, like think aloud too much on that topic, but I think it's worth noting that that's a really good research project. And if there's not already a paper on it, I would encourage somebody to do it.
For sure. Yeah. In fact, you know, I think like perhaps, you know, I think even I'm sort of like thinking about it, and I think that a lot of it also sort of ties into the purpose of music itself, right? And about the whole creational, you know, like process and like the purpose that it has. I think along those lines, I just like know a little bit as to, you know, what really is the purpose of music in that sense, and how really does it serve as a tool for communication, which is something that, right, you know, like you've looked at in your research as well.
Well, yeah, so my research is definitely more on the side of like production and creation. So I'm interested more in like the cultural industry side. So how do people arrange to like actually make these new objects and kind of see these creative projects through? But no, there's definitely on the other side of that, the like reception and leisure kind of side of music. You know, there's lots of excellent research on that, like in terms of like personal identity and how people use music to develop that or, yeah, support that. Or, you know, like we were already mentioning cultural capital and how that shapes, you know, people's comfort in developing a artistic practice or whatever. But that's also the same in terms of just developing, or sorry, not developing, but in terms of like consuming cultural goods and how those like reproduce symbolic boundaries. So yeah, in terms of like that sort of research, I would just leave it at that. I think what's really interesting from my perspective is more so how audiences are using consumption platforms or like how they're engaging with music through, you know, Instagram and Spotify and the things like that, and how that's changed the approaches that musicians need to take to connect with audiences. So I think that that's like a big change in terms of like consumption and audiences and leisure. That's super important to understand what musicians are doing and kind of where their struggles are, like what their struggles are grounded in. Because yeah, if they can't connect to audiences, then that's really tough. Yeah, I think that's more of like the, in terms of like, yeah, the context of my research and audiences and leisure, that's kind of more what's shaping my questions. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I think I myself can remember, right? Like it wasn't that long ago, you know, that we had CDs and we had, you know, like these USB sticks and we would just, you know, like transfer music through that. And now it's just so widely available, right? Like if you want a song, you know, just go online, you know, open up your phone and, you know, and just access like the song or the track that you want.
Yeah, so it really wasn't that long ago, right? Like, you know, I feel like I got to experience it a little bit longer because, yeah, I was born like in the 90s and I grew up in like a rural community. So we didn't get the internet for a long time. And so, you know, we were just like a few years behind everybody else, I think. So like, yeah, I remember growing up and having the CD wallet with the Discman on my school bus that was too bumpy to listen to. And then, you know, those MP3 players that held like 20 songs. What a time to be alive. But yeah, it was, you know, just thinking of my younger self on the school bus, like what a revolution, like to have every song at my, like to discover new music on my drive to school. That's new, right? Well, I mean, it happened in a different way, I guess.
for sure, definitely. And in fact, I think, you know, that also sort of, again, right, like, which is, you know, it like takes us back, you know, like the main question, which, you know, like you look at, right, which is, it all takes us back to, you know, the music producer at the end of the day, right? So you know, so how exactly, like, have you found that the whole production process, you know, has changed? Like, how was it earlier? Right, I'd like focus on that first, and then maybe like we look at, you know, like how it's like changed over time.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm not 100% sure how it's changed over time. Just like I can't speak to it because I haven't been there so long. In terms of like, just something I've definitely witnessed in my own lifetime is just the increasing accessibility of recording technology and production equipment and stuff. I remember being like amazed by like a portable 4-track recorder, and now it's like you can have a recording studio on your laptop, and yeah, like basically for a couple $100, like you can record things that are really, really excellent. So I think there's just probably more producers than there were, or actually, yeah, that isn't actually a really interesting theme in terms of how production and the producer in particular shapes the music that we hear, because they're like a really important, I call them like a gatekeeper or an intermediary, right? So somebody who shapes which artists get recorded and how the recordings turn out as well. So that's kind of like the role of the producer, is to translate an artist's idea for a song into an actual recording of one. Usually there's some collaboration there, but they generally have more knowledge about production software, which includes things like Ableton Live or Logic Pro, Fruit Loops, I think that's one, things like that. And so first off, it's worth noting something that hasn't changed so much, but is starting to change, is that music producers are almost exclusively men, or people who identify as men. Like, I think the most recent study that I've seen showed that only 2% of music producers are women, or people who identify as women. And so that's a pretty big discrepancy, and especially considering like the power that the producers have to shape recordings and kind of choose which artists they want to work with. That's definitely worth noting. And that's something that was bared out in my research. And so one of the things, I don't know, just that comes out of that, is that knowledge of music production software is actually becoming increasingly important for artists to understand. And that was one of the pieces of advice one of the songwriters I talked to in my research gave, was that all artists and songwriters, and she was especially like saying, like, I in my practice, I encourage women to like really just kind of learn, like, they don't need to be experts in production software, but just to kind of know the language of it so that they can engage with producers like in with that technical jargon that sometimes goes like throughout my research, it went over my head a lot, and I had to start learning it myself just to kind of understand what was going on. But what she was saying was that it's really important for an artist to kind of understand the technical work that like other intermediaries are doing, so that they can make sure that their work is heard the way that they want it to be. And so that they can exert some control over that. So production is really important, and it's kind of like a mystical, a lot of the creative process is a mystical thing. But in terms of music, I find that in terms of just like people who haven't done it before, or aren't, you know, super into like, yeah, behind the scenes music production processes, aren't super familiar with, but it's super crucial and worth learning more about if you're interested.
For sure. Yeah. In fact, you know, I think this reminds me of this one, sociology course I'd taken long, long ago, in which we were studying, you know, like the culture industry and all of these different things. And, you know, I think this one thread that came up was, you know, how if you look at all of like these different markets today, right, like whether it's, you know, music or art or everything, a lot of things have just been standardized, right? If I, you know, like were to listen to an artist like, I don't know, say Cardi B or Eminem in person, right? It's very different, right? You know, I think along those lines, like every single performance I listen to live, you know, even if it's by the same artist or like singing like the same exact song, right? Like there will be some element of variation. But then I think, you know, like if you have all of like this, you know, like high-tech equipment that comes in, like the quality and everything is going to be great, right? But then after listening to the same thing again and again and again, you know, there is this, you know, standardization that sets in, and, you know, that really, you know, like sets the standards, I guess. And I think, you know, and while of course, you know, we see it as a good thing and as an advantage, I think it maybe also, you know, takes us away from the human being behind the whole like process, right? Like if it makes sense.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I just like to know your thoughts on at like a societal, you know, like a fundamental level, right? Like what does all this technology, you know, like sort of do if you've looked at that.
Right. So, well, just to kind of repeat back, just to make sure I get it, like you're saying, in terms of art and, you know, especially mass produced art and things that are for a mass audience, there's like a lot of standards in terms of, you know, like just thinking of music, right? Like pop music is generally 3 minutes and 30 seconds. There's like a verse and there's a chorus and a hook and a bridge and then an ending or whatever. But I don't know, thinking of like that classic sociological insight from Becker's Art Worlds about like conventions, even though that these are constraining and like you kind of say, like, you can kind of use them to argue that there's a human component missing to some of this like mass produced stuff, it's worth noting that these conventions are always changing. And I think this relates back to like what we were talking about earlier when it comes to how audiences are engaging with music and like just the the constraints and affordances of like the media ecosystem we have now, right? So I don't know, it's conventions are really interesting to watch them change and to watch how artists challenge them. And to, I don't know, the one thing that's just immediately coming to my mind is the example of Tierra Whack's Whack World. I really love this story. I don't know if you've heard of this album, but it's just so cool because I felt like with that album and the kind of all of the creative output that came from it, it really helped to kind of like be like, hey, look, these are the standards that we have, or like, these are our conventions. And maybe you don't realize it, but like, check it out. And like articulated it, because I don't know, for people who are unfamiliar with that album, it was, yeah, it's like, it's called Whack World by Tierra Whack. And it's, I believe it's 15 tracks, and each of them are like exactly 1 minute. And the music videos for each 1 minute track was released on Instagram, which at that time, like, it was constrained by like videos could only be exactly 1 minute. So it was kind of using that as like a constraint to enhance like an artistic project or something, right? Or it worked out in that case. And then it also came out to be like a 15 minute video that kind of all fits together on YouTube, and the album's really cool. And you know, it kind of plays to that whole like people have short attention spans on social media, and social media has XYZ constraints. And so let's play within that. And so, yeah, I found that really interesting. Because it helps to show how like to be a successful artist nowadays, you need to think of ways of like sneaking into people's routines in a meaningful way, which that's just a thought one of the songwriters that Nancy Bam talked to described it as. And I think that, yeah, I don't know, trying to recognize the constraints and affordances of these different things that are part of our media ecosystem and how people consume music, super important. And yeah, that's just one example where I feel like they really, Tierra Whack really nailed it. It was both like very creative, very fun to listen to and watch, and like fit perfectly within the certain medium.
Mm-hmm, for sure, yeah. And I don't know, like, you know, for me personally, right, like, there are just so many artists. It's, I think, you know, like, you know, like after a while, I just feel like, you know, a lot of artists are very, very similar. So, you know, to find like one artist who, you know, like really like gets, you know, the lyrics and, you know, the entire, like the whole like melody and tune and everything that really, you know, meets what you're looking for at that time. I feel like it's a pretty rare thing, like at least for me. But yeah, right. I think, you know, I just like know a little bit about how, you know, especially, you know, like considering how like we have so many artists today, right, and you're all, you know, competing for attention in, you know, this big, yeah, you know, like space, right, like how exactly, mm-hmm, have audiences sort of, you know, like how do we as audiences interact with music differently, and how do we consume, mm-hmm, music differently in that sense?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, in terms of audiences, we engage with music differently in terms of like we've been talking about, right, like in terms of listening to like music catalogs that are available online and that are accessible through your phones and everything like that. But again, what I'm most interested in is how these different changes are affecting musicians and artists, and how they shape their practice and how they engage with audiences. And so just to kind of tie it back together, like these new consumption norms are kind of shaping like this trend, maybe not a trend, but are contributing to like the data driven nature of cultural industries and music. So, you know, obviously there's like a analog resurgence, and some bands are releasing things on like cassettes and whatever, which is relevant, but those still serve as like data points, right? Like you can, artists need to use, need to have some sort of data to prove that they have an audience to get shows and to get labels or whatever on their side and other intermediaries to support them. And so, yeah, I would say that the predominant kind of switch to streaming platforms has really shaped how artists measure their audiences. Like you probably saw at the end of last year, like all of the artists like posting their Spotify Wrapped and being like, oh wow, all these people from different countries and stuff like that, and like look at my streaming things. And if you know, take all of those and line them up, you can kind of see like, oh, okay, which artists are doing best, has the largest audience, which ones has the smallest ones. And then, you know, and artists use that too to kind of be like, okay, look at how many people we have in the city, you know, you should book us for this gig. Like that's kind of like what they use. And yeah, that leads me nicely to this other story I wanted to tell about kind of how musicians work with that in this kind of new ecosystem, and how, like, yeah, one of the, just the most creative ways I've seen an artist use Spotify and to collect data on their audience. I'm about to say a bunch of weird words, so I might have to say it twice just because I, yeah, like the band Vulfpeck, it's with a V-V-U-L-F-P-E-C-K, released an album called Sleepify, which is like Spotify, but sleeping. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it was, okay, it was all silent songs. So like, it was like basically, I think, a minute and a half of silence. So each, or maybe, yeah, each of the tracks were like 10 seconds or something. And so they asked their fans to play it on repeat when they went to bed. And then, so they collected all of the revenue from Spotify, which relates back to the Tierra Whack thing, which I think she also optimized, because like having these short 1 minute songs and Vulfpeck having like these short kind of 10 seconds or 30 second songs, that optimizes how much money you can make based on the listening time, right? Because it's, you get paid out per track, not how much time people listen to it. And I think you get paid a little bit more if people listen to the track completely. So having these short tracks is actually a really smart thing to have for an artist. But anyway, to finish this Sleepify story, basically they asked all their audience to do this. And then sooner or later, Spotify was like, okay, you got to cut it out because this is just, this is crazy. So they took the thing off, but they took the album offline. So you can't listen to it anymore. Listen in quotes. But they made about 10 grand off of it, which they used to fund a tour where there was no admission fee. So all the, like, it was a free tour, and they used all the data from the people who streamed as like the, to pick the cities in which they would play shows. So it was like really easy to book sold out shows in these cities because they're like, oh, wow, look, we have, you know, X thousand people streaming this silent album because they support us. They'll probably come to a free show, which they did. So yeah, and Vulfpeck hasn't stopped with the hilarious and innovative strategies to get audiences to engage with them and to just kind of get their name out there. Yeah, they recently like sold a track on one of their albums. It was like track 10 is for sale, and they sold it on eBay. So things like that, they're awesome. So, but yeah, just to kind of like conclude, it's like, being able to acknowledge like what are the constraints and affordances of this, like, of the current kind of consumption ecosystem, and to do things that will help you to kind of further your career. And in the case of like Vulfpeck, right, that's like, okay, we have this many fans in the city, so that makes it worth going there or not.
Oh, for sure, right? I think that's a really interesting story, because I've never heard of Sleepify, so yeah, so I'll maybe check it out for sure. Yeah, and I think, yeah, you know, I think like one sort of, you know, concluding question I'd like to ask about your research, again, you know, goes back to the question of audiences and listeners, right? And I think that, of course, because I think as we have so many different options today, we also have lower attention spans. I'm not sure if that's a myth, but it's something I've, you know, like constantly like heard about, right?
So yeah, that may or may not be true, but yeah, probably true in some ways and not in others. But yeah, anyway, sorry.
Yeah, so I was just wondering if that affected, you know, like the music production process. You know, I think, you know, like, is there any pressure to, you know, like create shorter sort of clips or songs, or does it, or maybe like make it more, you know, catchy in the beginning and then like, you know, like ease our listeners into it? Yeah, I'm just a bit curious to know as to what you think.
Yeah, for among the people that I talked to, it wasn't so much strategizing in that way, that like, oh, we need to make the song shorter. There was often like, it can't be too long, right? Like it can't be like there was often kind of a sense like it should be about 3.5 minutes within the pop formula. But for the most part, it was more about being consistent. So even, you know, whether or not it's true that audiences' attention spans are shortened, songwriters and artists told me that they needed to be top of mind of their audience, right? Like, so they couldn't go silent for a month. They had to keep posting on Instagram Instagram, had to keep kind of showing what people, what they were up to, making posts, stuff like that, just kind of staying relevant so that you can have a release schedule. Just like having the artist having a catalog, like a back catalog of stuff that's ready to be released or like nearly finished, so they can stay on top of mind with their audiences. And this relates back to that book, I already mentioned it, but the book I really like by Nancy Bam called Playing to the Crowd. She describes like a shift. Maybe this kind of talks to, this helps me to kind of get at one of the questions that you asked earlier about like shifts in, not so much producers, but how artists engage with their audiences. She talks about how in, you know, previous eras of the music industry, basically the pre-digital age, musicians and musical artists could like disappear into their mansions for months and just kind of work away at whatever they wanted to do or party or whatever. But she's saying now you can't do that and succeed. Like you need to, like, you know, the way that my research participants experienced that was like, I need to always be posting things on Instagram or I was saying, having a back catalog of stuff that's ready to be released, or just some sort of project on the horizon that's ready to be completed. Yeah, so I think that's how it manifests mostly. I think I've gotten to the answer to that question.
for sure, yeah. definitely, right. I think one final sort of, you know, question I'd like to ask you is that, like whenever we study a topic in the social sciences, I think, you know, we are studying human beings, right? So I think in that sense, mm-hmm. it makes it very different from studying, something in the natural sciences, because, you know, we aren't molecules in a lab. so that makes yes. it, I think a bit more challenging, right? Because I think somewhere or the other, we always have our own experiences that sort of come in and influence how we look at our research and our research subjects. So yeah, I just like to know a little bit as to whether you felt that your background or experiences or identity has influenced the course of your research, and in what way, if that's been the case.
Sure. Yeah. I love that. Like the comparison with like molecules in a vat. It's like, if you're going to use that for a social science, it's like, not only are you a molecule, but you're in the test tube. It's kind of hard to get a good vantage point from there. Mm-hmm. You got to use, as a social scientist, and like, you got to use your kind of personal experience to, I don't know, promote some questions and maybe guide you a little bit. This is different for different kind of schools of thought in social science, obviously. But in terms of ethnography and participant observation, yourself definitely has to come into it. I've been, music has been an interest of mine since I can remember, really. And I started playing bass guitar. It was my first instrument. When I was pretty young, I must have been 12 something. So I've carried that experience with me through my whole life and into my field work, because that helped me to kind of to start my research. When I started grad school at the University of Toronto, I joined an indie rock band and played bass for them, which helped me to kind of, have something to do at live shows and to have a reason to go to local rehearsal spaces and then talk to, the random people who happen to be there, and just kind of develop my network that way. So that really helped to just kind of being able to play bass and happen to being asked to join this band when I moved to Toronto, really helped to just set the foundation for developing connections in the Toronto music scene. And just kind of having opportunities. So like, for example, one of the things, other than just like playing shows and meeting songwriters and stuff, at our shows, the band got asked to, or we played some sort of event at like the Canadian Music Week or Indie Week. And those are like also music industry conferences. So we kind of had free access to those. So I used those opportunities to kind of just go to sessions and be like, hey, I'm doing research. You want to do an interview? Or is it cool if I come and hang out at a songwriting session? But like I said, the COVID pandemic definitely kind of put that project into a bit of a tailspin, but I had a good enough foundation built up before then, with just like personal connections and stuff. that helped me to just kind of recruit people and also to have people be comfortable enough to just like even jam with me, so that I could even observe their creative process, like to the point where I was participating in it. But yeah, so in terms of just like, yeah, my interest and practice of music, that really shaped my access to this community. And I don't think my dissertation research would be possible really without that kind of personal competency that I had. Obviously there's multiple ways of like getting into a, like integrating yourself into a musical community. But for me, I found that that really helped to make organic connections for sure.
Yeah, for sure, right? And I think that's really cool because, you know, I mean, we were just talking about molecules, and I think unlike, you know, other sort of fields, right? Like when you can sort of see yourself to be a part of your research subjects in some way, I think that makes it, you know, much more personal. And I think it, like, of course, like makes it more interesting as well. So yeah, I'm sure that, you know, and of course, you know, like the whole PhD process is also so long, and it can, and I'm sure that there are parts where you're thinking like, you know, why am I doing this? Like it's, but of course, no doubt. I think, yeah, but you know, I think of course, like if you're really, you know, interested into the subject, then of course it makes it much, much more interesting. So yeah, that's there. And yeah, that's about it from my end. So thank you, Taylor, for taking out the time today. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks so much for the really insightful questions. It was really great talking to you. And just, yeah, like preparing and chatting through this has been really nice to just thinking a bit more broadly about my research. And yeah, with this COVID pandemic, it's not always easy to find interested people to chat with. So I really appreciate it.
For sure. Likewise.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. It was a really good time.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, then please do subscribe or follow. You can also follow us on Twitter or Instagram at the handle DTRRH Podcast for further updates.